Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is gaming writer Michael Kaplan. We're going to be talking about several of his stories today, including one about James Grossjean and Richard Munchkin, and another about Phil Ivey and his Baccarat partners. If those names don't interest you, you're listening to the wrong show. In addition, on the gamblingwithanedge.com webpage, we've posted links to the articles that we're talking about. So if our brief discussion of these whet your appetite, you can read the original very easily. Okay. Michael Kaplan, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's first talk about James Grossjean and Richard Munchkin attacking card craps. We saw and spoke about on the air a version of this article a few months ago. The link we're talking about today is an expanded version of the previous article. How does it happen that you're able to get paid twice to produce two articles that are 80% in common? All writers would like gigs like that.
Well, you're able to sell the second rights. So the Times had a shot. You know, they published the first the first rights of the story, so it ran on there. Then after a certain period of time, it becomes yours again, and you could sell it wherever you want. But whoever's buying it knows that it exists, you know, in some form already exists online. So you get a little bit less money. But I kind of like the idea though of being able to go into more detail on that actual play, because there was a lot of stuff then that I took out and put in more stuff about the Grossjean play.
It's like the director's cut when they re-released the movie.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. Now, James Grossjean is notorious about not giving interviews. He won't come on this show, and Richard is one of his best friends. So, how did you pull this off?
Well, I've known James for a while. I first met him at the Blackjack Ball. I'm trying to remember now when it was. It would have been in the early 2000s. And we chatted a little bit and kind of, you know, exchanged phone numbers. And then he called me once out of the blue and said, oh, would you like to come do a story with me? And I was like, yeah. And I went and did it. And we did it for Cigar Aficionado. And then we'd been friends after that. And a couple ups and downs. But generally, you know, we had a pretty good rapport. And he had a very specific reason for wanting to do this story. But I think I'm going to let him tell you when he comes on. I'm not sure I'm at liberty to say why. Although Richard might know.
Do you know what that is, Richard?
Actually, no. I don't know. I don't think I knew that. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say it or not.
Probably shouldn't then.
But yeah, he was up for doing this, and it was, you know, the thing about James is once he commits to doing something, he really commits to it. And, you know, he went out and found a brand new game for me to watch him play.
Right. So you should go over what the pitch was in the beginning, right? The pitch was not, hey, come to Oklahoma and watch us play card craps. It was, what was the pitch?
To the Times?
No, for his pitch to you.
Oh, no, I went to him. The very first time I did a story with him, he had a game on a boat in Indiana. And he invited me to come along and watch him play. And it kind of came out of the blue. And honestly, I'm still not sure why he thought he wanted to do it, but we did it. And it was really interesting. Even though, frankly, I didn't even get to watch him play because we went there and the game was closed. Then he wasn't sure when it was going to open. And I didn't want to just like sit endlessly in this little motel in southern Indiana waiting for it to open. So I basically didn't even get to watch him play. I got the details later and was able to, you know, incorporate that into the story. But I wasn't there for the actual play. And another time, though, I did get to watch him play in Atlantic City. And I mean, it is pretty unbelievable to be sitting at a table with this guy in the casino, and he's basically calling out every down card that the dealer has, which was pretty cool. You know, he has code words for each card. And so if you know the code, he's announcing them to the table, which is pretty funny. And it was actually incredibly interesting. And I was like, yeah, I would love to do another story with him. And then this thing came up for the Times, and I mean, I kind of pitch it as a way broader story. I actually pitched it focusing on Don Johnson, and they weren't interested in him. They found James to be more interesting, which they probably were right. And then I called him and asked if he would do it, and he was like, I don't know, I don't know. And he agreed to, but he had like a specific reason.
But when you asked him to do the story and he initially said yes, the idea was he was going to find some new game and figure out a new way to beat it, and it just happened to turn out to be this card craps game. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes, he was going to find a new game and figure out how to beat it, and frankly, I think he viewed this as, yeah, I'm going to do it for the story because it's not going to be that good of a game.
Right.
I think that's the reason he wanted to do it. And it wound up being this ridiculously good game that lasted for quite a long period of time.
Yeah.
Although the weekend Richard was there, they bombed at it. But maybe Richard isn't very good.
I went on a little after that.
Yeah, that was, I know, I was a little disappointed from my story. I called my editor. But you know what? They got it at least. Because, I mean, I've done stories for other places where the person you're writing about lost and like, what he does doesn't work. And you're like, well, that's not true. You know, it didn't work that time. But, you know, I mean, look, if you have like a 10% advantage, that's a huge advantage. You still have, you know, a 40%. It's like you have a 40% chance of losing, right?
45.
A 45% chance of losing.
Well, you're talking about one bet. But, I mean, it depends on how long you get to play.
Yeah,
I mean,
but, yeah, over time you're going to win. But, like, in a weekend, like a lot of things could happen.
Right. But actually, that was one of the things that I liked about the article was usually people think of gambling, it's going to be something, and the guy's just going to go in and win a ton of money. And eventually, yes, that happened, but at least you showed that over a weekend, anything can happen.
Well, a thing that irks me about gambling books is a particular blackjack story, a particular blackjack book about the MIT team, and it looks like they never lose, which is absolutely not true. I mean, you know, there's plenty of room for losing. I mean, you're going to win in the long run. I mean, you're going to make your money, and you might not be willing to leave the casino, you know, a casino trip until you win, but that's not even true, because, like, look, you know, you guys are consummate professionals, and doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah, and I think that the writers, I mean, that was a case of a writer not really understanding, because I think the game is more interesting when you show how people deal with the losses.
Yeah.
Because that is a big part of it.
Well, yeah. Well, the funny thing is, though, guys like, well, okay, like the weird thing is, I wound up playing with them, and we did have a big loss. I wound up playing with James and his group. I was BPing for them. And we had a big loss one night. And having card counters are like, oh, yeah, well, you know, you're going to lose all the time. You know, they write off losses like it's nothing. These guys lost, like, you know, not as much as you would even lose on a bad card counting session. And they were actually pretty upset. They were more upset than I thought they would be. And I kind of was sort of rolling with it, having more of a card counter mentality, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, it happens. And it kind of felt like we're like, yeah, well, it actually doesn't happen. It wasn't my fault. Like, it was somebody else who lost a lot. But this guy just got incredibly unlucky. I mean, you know, it happens. But that was kind of interesting to me, that they do not take losing all that well. Take losing less well than I would have thought. Although, you know, when we were there for your thing, it felt like it was like still getting figured out. So I think the idea was, yeah, okay, well, we might lose now, but we're figuring out how to do this.
That's one thing the article makes clear, is this is an evolving art, and James is continually tweaking it. And this AP stuff is hard work, even for the best in the world, which might be James.
Well, what interested me was that this guy was, I mean, when I did the play with him, he kind of never slept. You know, everybody wanted bedrooms. He was like it was like in this little house. Everybody wanted bedrooms. He was on the sofa. I mean, you know, he'd be up half the night. He, you know, shut his eyes for 20 minutes. And when he wasn't sleeping, he was on his computer.
Yeah.
I mean, he was not like sitting there, you know, listening to like, I don't know, his new favorite band or something.
No, I mean,
that guy has a work ethic like, you know, you kind of wouldn't believe. I mean, however successful he is and however much money he makes, I mean, like, he earns it. Like, you know, he works really hard.
Well, he also has some incredible metabolism. I mean, he's never done drugs. He's never taken a drink. But he sleeps maybe 2 hours of 3 hours a day. I mean, and often, you know, he'll take cat naps of, you know, 30 seconds over on third base. You know, you'll look over and his eyes are closed. But when the dealer gets to him, he's awake again.
That's a real good cover. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, they thought he was just a complete degenerate. I mean, like, they thought that he was, like, some idiot who just was, like, you know, winning and losing his $5 bets. And he's, like, running this whole game. I mean, it was pretty interesting.
Now, to obtain the edges he does, I suspect James is anal about everything to the nth degree. Did he insist on seeing your story before it was published? And if so, what did you agree?
No, I wouldn't let him see the story. I agreed to kind of go through it and like do a pretty significant fact check with him, which I didn't. That didn't break any rules. I didn't do anything different than what the fact checker from the Times would do. And there were a couple things that he asked me to kind of to tweak a tiny bit to mask certain things. And these things were really tiny. Like it didn't, you know what I mean, to the point that It didn't, like, if it really mattered, I would have had to say, okay, yeah, this is different than what he actually did, but because they're pretty strict. But he was actually incredibly open to stuff. And I mean, you know, he was really, really great to work with. And then, you know, at the 11th hour, he went through a long fact check with the Times and went through it all. I mean, he knew what was in there because their fact checks are pretty significant. But he was awesome.
Very good. Let's move on to a different story. February 2014, there was an extended article by you in Playboy magazine about Phil Ivey. In the article, Phil comes across to me anyway as a brilliant, successful guy who likes to party hardy with his friends, but ultimately seems to be a pretty unhappy guy. Was that your experience?
He did not strike me as unhappy. He was, you know, I mean, it was the beginning of this of his legal troubles, you know, for the play he did with Kelly, for the Baccarat play.
Uh-huh.
But he kind of seemed pretty, I don't know, he didn't strike me as, I mean, it's weird that it's interesting that was a takeaway that you had from the story, because he didn't strike me as sad, really. He struck me as like a guy who just was like, you know, working and slogging through it. Like, you know what I mean? Like everybody else, but he has a pretty decent, I mean, he seemed like he had a pretty decent life. I mean, one thing I'll say about that guy is he loved being surrounded by people and he spent money. Like he was not one of these nitty gamblers who, you know, are getting, you know, taxi receipts for a $4 cab ride or, you know, or walking instead of taking the $4 cab ride. I mean, he spends money and he has a great time. It was really funny. I remembered hearing a story once that he got his hair cut like every other day at the Bellagio. He went to the barber shop there and got his hair cut every other day. And I was
this would be shaved bald haircut.
I guess. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool, you know? And, you know, he had all these comps there and he was able to do that. And I was like, wow, that's cool. And then I go up to his apartment and there's this guy there with kind of like a, I wouldn't say he's a goofy looking guy, but like not a guy who you said, oh yeah, this is like some, you know, great guy. He had a shirt that said, you know, barber across it and he had barbering tools and he's giving out haircuts. And one of Ivy's guys go, you want a haircut? I'm like, nah, I think I'm okay. Then I'm like thinking to myself, wow, poor Phil, you know, he's really gone downhill. He's got like this weird guy coming here and giving everybody haircuts in his house instead of going to the, you know, hair salon at the Bellagio. So I think I did say to one of, you know, Phil's guys, I said, oh, you know, I thought that he got his hair cut at the Bellagio. He goes, oh, no, this is the master barber from the Bellagio. He comes to us now. I was like, oh, okay, well, okay, that answers that question. Don't feel bad for Phil. And I will tell you one funny thing that's not in the story is that I was with him at the World Series of Poker, and he, you know, like all the poker players, they've got those honey wagons behind the Rio. You know, like these trailers, like those trailers that movie stars use when they shoot movies.
I didn't know that.
And they hang out in there between, you know, during breaks or if they're between, you know, they want to just, you know, take a break. And, you know, because sometimes people go in late at the, you know, at the
so main does the event. Rio provide that to them or they provide
the
their own?
They provide, I guess, the parking. I mean, they probably pay for the parking, but these guys get it. Daniel Negreanu has one. Ivy has one.
You would think they would just get a room or a suite or whatever.
It's like right outside this back entrance from the Rio. They don't have to walk through the hotel. It's like a like
but
a
these like are big
walk.
Campers or something.
Yeah.
Big
yeah,
buses
they call them
sort.
Honey wagons.
Right. Well, on a movie,
yeah.
Honey wagons have more than one room in one coach, but a
these
star
are...
wagon would be an individual has the whole thing to himself.
Yeah, he had the whole okay. They had the whole things to them. So they all have the whole thing to themselves. So I'm out with him in the trailer or whatever, and we're there. We're about to sit down and start talking. Then all of a sudden, this Chinese woman with really long hair and giant sunglasses walks in. She turns around and she goes, "Phil, baby." And I'm like, oh, that's got to be Kelly. And it was the only time I saw Ivy look rattled. And I watched them lose, you know, over $100,000 in like about 3 minutes playing Baccarat in Caesar's Palace. He looked way more concerned then than he did after he lost the money at Baccarat. He goes, "Oh, you got to go." I'm like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah, you can't stay here." He goes, I got to talk to her. And I'm like, oh, man, that's pretty interesting. And I chose not to put it in because, A, I don't know, I kind of felt like he didn't invite me into his trailer so I would run into her. And it seemed kind of unfair. And it seemed like, what was the point even? Because what do you say? Oh, yeah, so she walked in the trailer and said, it's like funnier if I tell the story now. But, you know, at the time, it was sort of like, and I didn't know enough. I couldn't have enough details about really the whole thing that happened. And it was agreed that we weren't really going to talk about it. That was one of the, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. We agreed to that ahead of time. So I was like, it would have been kind of not really fair. So I didn't put it in the story, but it was pretty funny.
About that time, there was the Full Tilt fiasco, and Phil was getting a lot of heat for that because he was one of the faces of Full Tilt. Did the Full Tilt thing bother him more or less than the lawsuits with Crockford's and Borgata?
I think they were different. I think that the Full Tilt thing, my recollection, is that it bothered him because he felt that it hurt his reputation unfairly.
Well, he sued them, right?
Yeah.
He sued Full Tilt for exactly that.
Yeah, he felt like they put him in a bad spot and like he was, you know, a sponsored, you know, I guess he owned a piece of it, but I'm not even sure if he was an investor or not an investor. I really don't know. But he felt like they treated him poorly. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's two sides to that story, but that was his take. And I think as far as the lawsuit went, I mean, it was also the beginning of it, and I think he was still, you know, trying to figure out what was going to happen. I think he was pretty optimistic that it would get resolved in his favor. And it still might. I mean, it's now they did get a new hearing, I understand.
Yeah.
There's like an appeal that's going to happen, so they might get their money.
All right, let's move on. An article in Thrillist called "How I Won Millions in Casinos, Then Lost It All, and Wound Up in Handcuffs." It's an article about a woman you call Miss Brown, who was a successful blackjack and poker player, and then got busted at Planet Hollywood while carrying multiple IDs. Things go downhill for her, and then something happens that turns her life around. It's an ordinary thing, but doesn't usually turn your life around.
Yeah, she had a baby.
And usually getting pregnant does not... When your
life... I think it depends on what age you are when you get pregnant.
I guess.
And she's... I think... You know what? She's a really, really cool person. She's an awesome mom. I mean, I liked her a lot. I thought she was great. And she... You know, I was like interested partly in the fact that she's a woman, like in this world. I mean, it just seems like a rough. It's rough enough being a guy and getting pushed around in casinos, but to be a woman and just, you know, it just seems like that much worse somehow.
Well, we have talked about her in the past because of the when Bob Nersessian's been on the show, because she had a pretty famous case where she was coming back from Puerto Rico, and the DEA confiscated $90,000 of her money.
That's in the story.
Yeah. So I've talked to her a number of times about trying to get her on the show, and so far she has declined. But one day, so.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought she was pretty cool. I thought she was really clever. I thought she was smart. I thought she, you know, she worked pretty hard.
She has a blog now too, which
I think she's actually a really good writer. I think her writing is really good. I like reading her stuff.
I'm trying to. Do you remember what her blog is called off the top of your head?
I'll look
it up and I'll put it in the notes of the show.
Yeah, because we should definitely link to it because it's worth looking at. And I, you know, I think she might have a book in her. I mean, I think she might want
to
do a book.
Well, she did say if she gets a book deal, she will come on the show to promote it.
Well, that would be. So. I'm sure she will do that.
Even if she got an, even if she got a book deal, that means it's, you know, 5 to 10 years down the road.
Yeah.
Before
yeah, exactly. I was really happy she spoke with me because I, you know, I kind of felt like it was a little bit of a crapshoot. I mean, I know her a little bit. In fact, I spoke with her for the Times story. I went and met with her at a restaurant over at Red Rock, and we had dinner and we talked, and it just seemed like what she did, it just seemed different. I don't know, it just didn't fit in with that story, but I just thought she was really interesting and really liked her.
Well, you know, she reminds me in a way of Kat Hulbert, who was in my book, and what I found interesting about Kat was she started in blackjack and transitioned into poker, which is exactly what Miss Brown did.
Yeah.
And, you know, although 20 years later, 30 years later or something. So
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I find that transition tremendously interesting when, it, you know, if they talk about the differences between blackjack and poker and the type of people involved.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I've talked to blackjack players. Well, I mean, Andy Block did it.
Yep.
I mean, I've talked to blackjack players who were like, oh, yeah, I don't want to play poker because I don't want to take money from people who are, you know, less skilled than, like, they feel like they don't want to victimize people. I mean, I don't know if I really buy that, but I've heard that from blackjack players.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a confrontational nature to poker that doesn't exist when you're playing against the house. I mean, there is that. You have
That's
to be
true.
Able to hold, you know what I mean? And you could be playing against people smarter than you. No matter how smart you are, you know, there might be somebody smarter than you.
Actually, that was one of the reasons I gave up backgammon, was because to be really successful at it, you had to seek out the kind of the sickest individuals, you know, the best players for you to play against were the degenerate gamblers that were just punishing themselves. And I did I don't know why I wouldn't find that as distasteful at a poker table. Maybe because it's disguised when there are 7 or 8 people at the table. When it's an individual, I don't know, it can get pretty ugly sometimes.
I think it was either Eric Seidel or Steve, the guy they call Steve Z. I think Zolotow is his last name. One of them told me that the idea of spending their lives you know, traveling the world and looking for live ones was just not what they wanted to do once backgammon became like a difficult thing to make money at in New York, you know, after Snowy.
Yep.
All right. We're talking to writer Michael Kaplan. We have many more questions for him, including an advantage play involving a stripper. First, we're going to take a brief commercial break.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. Throughout June, there's a half-price gas and or food promotion. Earn $50 Chevron cards and or $50 Smith's cards for half price for points earned and redeemed in June. Usually 8,333 points is worth $25 in cash or free play. In June, if you earned it and redeemed it in June, it's worth a $50 gift card. Maximum 10 cards total per month in any mix between Chevrons and Smiths. The next semester of free video poker classes at the South Point will be on Wednesday, noon, between August 2nd and October 4th. The complete schedule is on bobdancer.com. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Super Peak and Play Poker. This is an 8 coins per line game where you get a peek at the first card off the pack, and you get to choose whether or not you want that card or not. For example, if you were dealt 2 pair, and the next card off the top would not complete a full house, you reject that card and take the next one. If it would complete the full house, you'd keep the card. It's a slower than average game because you have 6 cards to consider, not 5. And if you want to keep the 6th card, you actually have to hold it. Commercially available software will not handle this game, so you have to build your own in order to analyze it.
All right, we're back. Another article in Thrillist is How I Make $300,000 in Las Vegas Stripping. It is not about gambling, but rather a high-paid stripper whose main claim to fame is no silicone. So, Michael Kaplan, do you think the woman in this article is an advantage player?
Yeah, she is definitely an advantage player. I mean, she... Like, I mean, you know, she prepared for, you know, I think there are some people who are strippers because it's an easy way, you know, relatively easy way to make money. And, they go, you know, they go in there in whatever condition they're in, whatever mood they're in, they do whatever. She went in there. She definitely had strategies for taking money from, you know, for getting money from people. She was very well spoken. She was super polite. She didn't seem like, you know, hardened or beaten up at all. And she said she'd go to the gym right before she went to the club. She'd get her hair done. She'd get her nails. She would do every single thing she could do to make herself look as appealing as possible. And once there, I mean, you know, she had strategies. I mean, you know, she would talk to people. She had strategies for holding on to her money, you know, not getting her money taken away or lost. And, you know, making sure her clothing, I think she told me some story about her clothing getting stolen once when she was, you know, early on. So, you know, she took care of herself in that environment, and she had stories about, you know, men just wanting to talk to her because, you know, I mean, I guess, I don't know, you know, when you hear about somebody getting like an hour-long lap dance, I mean, at a certain point, you would think a couple songs in, it's like, okay, you know, yeah, this is fun, but right. You know, like she would get guys to hang out with her because she would talk to them and she would converse, and she was really well-spoken. She was smart. She was funny. I mean, I found her really, really charming and nice and not bitter or, you know, or any of those, you know what I mean? And she didn't seem mercenary, you know?
Did she have a plan?
Her plan was to start investing in real estate, which if she did it then, I mean, I don't know what Vegas and real estate in Vegas is still slightly soft, but
it's been pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, if she did it a couple of years ago, she might have made out okay.
That would have been a good time.
But that was her plan, was to start buying real estate. Because she goes, I don't plan on doing, I think she was like in her early 20s, and she was like, I don't plan on doing this past 30. Like, I don't want to be some 35 or 40-year-old stripper, you know, trying to make it. So, yeah, she totally had a plan, and she knew that she had a short shelf life.
How did you find her?
I talked to the guys at Thrillist, and they said, yeah, you want to do a story about a stripper who makes a ton of money in Vegas. And I'm like, all right. So I spoke with,
all right.
Well, you know, I said, okay, let me try to find somebody. Yeah. I don't know that he, I don't know. Yeah. I think I spoke with him. I don't think he had a suggestion. I spoke, there's a strip club in Miami called 11. And it's a 24-hour strip club. And I thought, and they've got a zillion strippers there. And I mean, like all these big DJs come and play there. It's kind of a cool place. But I thought one of the guys from there would be able to help me, and like they sort of couldn't. And then I talked to, there's a guy named Brandon Roque who has been described to me as, at one point he was the fixer for the guys that own, you know, Tao Group. And he was a super great, he's a great guy. And he, at that point, he was working for the Crazy Horse too. When they were trying to turn it, is it Crazy Horse 2 or 3? It's like the popular Crazy Horse. And they were trying to turn it into a like an after-hours bar. And I was in Vegas, and I knew somebody who knew him, and she told him I was trying to do this thing. And then I ran into him at a Cascade concert. You know, he's the DJ at over at the Wynn. We were like backstage there, and he came up. He said, oh, I got somebody for you. And he gave me her number, and I called her, and she was like, yeah, I'll do it. And yeah, it was great. It was really, really cool.
Should do a follow-up. How many years ago was that?
Yeah, it was a couple years. Yeah, she's doing now. Yeah, right. I actually did call her about something else I was writing. I was doing a story about strippers who travel to the Super Bowl. And those are advantage players. Like, they're traveling to the Super Bowl to make money stripping. And I was trying to find if she knew any people. And she sort of was like, no, I got to go. She wasn't that charming in that conversation. Yeah. I think she did the story. She was happy she did the story. And, you know, she moved on from me. It happens.
All right. Moving on. Another Thrillist article was about Bob Nersessian. Now, he's a hero to us on this show and has been a guest a dozen or more times. Rather than go through this article, I want listeners to know it's on the reading list. It'll remind you of how good he is, and many of the stories in that article have been at least mentioned on this show.
Well, those are the ones he could talk about. Because I think he's got some really good stories he certainly won't talk to me about.
Yeah, I actually talked to him just the other day. He called me about a case he was working on. I was like, you probably can't talk about this on the air yet, right? And he was like, no, I can't. I said, well, once it's all settled, we'll have to talk about this the air.
What I found interesting about him, though, is that like this is the thing he's passionate about, but it's not really what he makes his money. This is not like representing APs is not like the lion's share of his income, is the impression that I had.
Oh, I got the impression that it was, that he's sort of that his business has kind of become.
Okay, well, I'll defer to you on that. But
I don't know that. I mean, I don't know that.
I thought that he did other stuff. I mean,
oh, he does.
He's very what I found interesting is like how passionate he is about defending APs and the fact that he himself has no interest in gambling. He said he'll play slot. maybe you know him better than I do.
I think he would volunteer to be a big player on anything that James Grosstein wanted him to do.
Okay, well, I think everybody in this room would do that.
Only people who like money.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Edward Tiger Mike Davis is a name I didn't know until I read your piece from the New York Post. Tell us about him.
Yeah, this guy is an amazing Las Vegas character. I met him through Jesse Waits, who used to be in charge of like excess at the Wynn, and he ran a restaurant there called Botero. And you know, we'd get together sometimes for dinner. We're friendly, and so he invites me to dinner. He goes, "Oh yeah," he goes, "my friend Mike is going to be there." He goes, "He's one of the biggest gamblers in the Wynn." He goes, "So it's all off the record." I'm like, as I've told him, because everything we do is off the record until we say it's on the record. So don't worry. So I get there, and I figure Mike is going to be, you know, some kind of guy in his, some flashy guy in his 30s. You know, Mike is like, he was in his 80s at that point, and this guy, I can curse, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, this guy was hilarious. I mean, he's sitting there, and he's the biggest gambler in the Wynn, and he's sitting there eating, and he's going, this fucking food sucks. This food tastes like shit. Fucking, and he eats there every night. So it's not like he's never eaten there before. He eats there every night with Jesse. And he's like, these oysters, fucking gritty, tastes like shit. And then Jesse looks up at him and goes, Mike, you like eating shit? And he goes, what are you talking about? He goes, well, you're eating those oysters. And it was just, this guy was amazing. I mean, like, you know, and he's giving everybody in the place. He wanted, at the end of the meal, he wanted some strawberries. And he goes, can you bring me some? He goes, you know, I want some strawberries. And the waiter goes, ooh, you know, I don't know that we have them. And he looks at the man and goes, you got all this exotic fucking shit. You don't have any strawberries? He goes, run to the grocery store and buy some. And then the guy goes, well, let me go in the kitchen and see what we have. So he comes running. He goes, oh, yeah, we have them. We have them. And then so Mike goes, yeah, you know, can you bring it to me with some cream? So they bring it to him with cream. And it's like all soupy. He goes, I got to eat this with a fucking spoon or something. He says, but when your only form of currency is the $100 bill and you like throw them around, everybody puts up, you know, nobody really minds. And it turns out that the guy does kind of have a heart of gold. I mean, he's a gruff guy, and he was the biggest gambler in the Wynn. I mean, and he had this crazy story. You know, he married when he was like 18. He became the chauffeur for the publisher of the biggest newspaper in Colorado. That guy died. He married her widow, divorced her, got a bunch of money, and got into the wild. He became a wildcatter. He had a lot of success with oil wells and made a ton of money. Loved to gamble. He had a very famous girlfriend, the woman who Sam Giancana was involved with. McGuire.
Yeah.
Phyllis McGuire.
She lives on the Vegas Country Club.
Well, that was the house he bought for her. And he stole her apparently from Sam Giancana, and they had some confrontation.
That doesn't sound like a healthy way to go about your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she said to him, you get your head blown off. And he was like, yeah, I don't care. And, you know, this guy, the story is that he was the only person besides Steve Wynn who had his own villa at the Wynn. And like, he basically didn't have to check in or check out. That was always his. You know, once he died, it went back. It's not like he got to keep it.
Oh, he died.
Yeah, he died, and that's why I got to write the story, because I was always saying, Mike, I really want to do a story with you. We should do some great story. And he goes, yeah, he goes, I'll only do it if you guarantee. I go, oh, we could probably do a book, you know? Because this guy's life was, he was talking about being involved. He knew stuff about the Kennedy assassination. He had all this great stuff. Like, his stories were sick. And it was weird. Like, you think they're not true, and then you read the Giancana book, and he's mentioned as one of the oil guys that gave Giancana money for I don't remember what it was for now, but he said, oh, yeah, we rounded up the oil guys. We had Mike from, you know, and I assume it was him. Because he said, yeah, he and Giancana straightened things out, and they had, you know, a good relationship. So I'm guessing that he was. So it was interesting that you see that after he says all that, you go, well, that's true. It sounded outrageous. And I want to do something. He goes, oh, the only way I'll do it is if you guarantee me that Al Pacino will play me in the movie. I'm like, okay. I go, I can't make that kind of guarantee. And then he had this guy, Adam, who was like his right-hand man who was going to try to help. But like, he just would never do it. He kind of wanted to do it, but wouldn't do it. And then when he died, I was like, I spoke with a couple of his relatives, a couple of his friends, and they're like, yeah, you know, kind of had their blessing to do the story. I wouldn't have done it. You know, because I felt like he was a pretty secretive guy. He didn't really want to be written about. And if these guys weren't going to cooperate, I wasn't going to do a kind of really cheesy write around. But a handful of people cooperated, including Jesse and, you know, some other people who knew him pretty well. And, you know, I got some good stuff. It was a really cool story. I was really glad to have gotten to do that story. And everybody liked it, which I was happy about, because it definitely could have gone either way.
Oh, Phyllis McGuire would make a great story if you... You
if
know,
she would she talk. Would,
yeah.
She supposedly has like the greatest collection of like vintage designer dresses, like from, I guess, the 50s on up. And they're all sitting in her closet, draped in plastic, and they're all in perfect condition. I mean, it's supposed to be pretty unbelievable. Not that I'm like some big, you know, fashion writer or something, but she would be really interesting to interview. I agree with you. Get her on the show.
Moving on to another article. A cigar aficionado article called Cheater Catcher is about a successful surveillance guy whose job it is to catch cheaters and advantage players. Although he's on the opposite side that APs are on, I found him likable, diligent, and knowledgeable. Players would do well to read this article. Now, you call him BC. What did you learn about surveillance when talking to him?
One thing I learned is that most surveillance guys don't know what the hell they're doing. I mean, that was one thing he told me. He said, yeah, most of the people are, you know, are pretty bad and pretty inept, and they don't. He got like really obsessed with it. I mean, he claims that he gave the Greeks their name. He started calling the blackjack team the Greeks because he got tired of using all these long names to describe everybody. And he just, you know, you look doubtful.
No, I mean, that may well be true. I don't know.
So he started calling them the Greeks instead of calling them, you know, instead of saying, oh, I mean, I don't even know all of their last names. But instead of, you know, continually using these long last names to describe the team's leaders, he called them the Greeks. And that name, he claims, stuck. But I like the idea that he was that into it. I mean, he supposedly has a big library of gambling books. You know, he's friends with Steve Forte, and you don't.
I don't know. You didn't use the person's real name, right? So I have always had a guess.
Well, we have a mutual friend who could tell you his real name.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Anyway, I have a guess as to who it is, but I'm assuming, in fact, I think we asked him to be on the show, and he thought that his corporate overlords, if it's the guy I'm thinking of,
it probably is.
Wouldn't,
well, his, you know, voice, his voice would have been distinctive enough that, you know, if he was.
Well, no, he would have, he wanted permission, right? To.
Now, Richard's asking about a guy named Ted Whiting, who is.
Oh, no, oh, it's not him.
Oh, okay.
It's not Ted. It is not Ted Whiting.
Okay. Yeah, that's who I thought it was about. So,
yeah, if we could have gotten Ted on the show, that would have been a show that Richard was sick and would have to call in from
Skype.
Home.
I would have been on Skype. But
I think Ted Whiting is a really interesting guy. I mean, one thing that I really like about him is, to me at least, like, he struck me as a real straight shooter. Like, when I wrote the original version of the New York Times story, he was in it, and he said to me he does not think that edge sorting is cheating. Which I thought, coming from a casino guy, That was a pretty interesting statement. I mean, he said cheating is when you're using an outside device or you're slipping cards into the game or you're doing stuff to the cards. Because if you're edge sorting, you're just doing what you're not breaking any of the any laws. And he goes, and it was interesting, like in Nevada, they didn't, you know, Kelly won money from casinos in Nevada. None of the Nevada casinos went after her. Maybe they knew that they couldn't get the money.
Well, Bob Nersessian said there's no way that the casinos would have a chance in Nevada.
Well, I found it really refreshing, like that he was smart enough and that he just was honest enough to say it's not cheating.
Well, the reason I thought it was Ted was because when you said you learned that there are so few of these guys who actually know anything, I think he is one of the few guys that actually knows something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And takes it seriously and you know, yeah.
Yeah, so. But he's, I thought he was a very stand-up guy. And I really liked him, and I appreciated that he was, you know, willing to talk to me and be honest, because not everybody is up for doing that.
Right. So, but let's go back to BC then. What were you going to say about BC? That because we kind of got sidetracked here to Ted Whiting.
Ted Whiting would have definitely not done it. He would have just done it under his name or not done it.
Yes. And exactly. If he were going to come on the show, he would, of course, do it as himself, but he would have to get permission to do that.
And the MGM corporate did not feel it was beneficial to their bottom line for him to come on the air.
I understand that.
Which cannot...
But we would love to have you on, Ted. So.
And he does listen to the show, at least some of the issues that I do know. But it was interesting that the Borgata was half-owned by MGM Grand.
My understanding is that the gambling laws in New Jersey are very different than the gambling laws in Nevada. I mean, one thing, and I mean, this may be accurate, it may be in it because I didn't check it, but a person I think of as being fairly knowledgeable, he told me, and he commented on my Facebook page, that New Jersey has a fighting chance in the case against Kelly and Phil, and that what the judge said maybe didn't make a whole lot of sense, but there is a law against doing things that alter the odds of the game. And, you know, but you could argue that's card counting. I mean, you could argue that if you're sitting at the table and the dealer is on, I don't know, antidepressants, and for some reason they're revealing every card, and that you just are sitting there and you see the card, I mean, are you not supposed to who would not take advantage of that?
Yeah.
But
they're saying if I get up from the table because the count is negative
that you've
and
altered,
move to a different table, I've altered
yeah,
the, you know. That, but it also means that, and I've said this about Nevada, right? That they altering the outcome of the game, altering the odds of the game, right, is defined as cheating.
Right.
So here in Nevada, it's common to have dealers who preferentially shuffle. So they are altering the odds of the game by shuffling away positive decks.
Right.
But, yeah, try to get them arrested for cheating or prosecuted
good luck
for that. Yeah.
So I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. But I think I digressed.
It's okay. I love your digressions. But since we were talking about Atlantic City, let's digress. There was a Casino 888 biography of Don Johnson.
Yes.
And it was written somewhat before he became the last Blackjack Hall of Fame member.
It was.
Quite a guy. Been on the show 3 times, and he's definitely charming and likable. One of the things that both Richard and I had heard, but it wasn't mentioned on the air here previously, is that when he made some $15 million attacking loss rebates in Atlantic City, he went in with a team, including a very good hole card reader, and all-around AP, and bunches of pretty girls to distract the dealers and hit people, and pit people.
Yeah, well, and they also would eat cards. I mean, he told me this. I'm not, like, you know, saying something that's, you know, out of school. He told me this straight up. Like, he didn't say, don't use this. I mean, you know, he would have them sitting there, and he'd give them money when, you know, up front, let them play. And, you know, when the count was... you know, when in bad situations, they would use up cards until it became a good situation, and they would play. And, you know, and I think it was distracting to the casino. Like, you know, what's going on? Why are all these people playing?
And well, he was also using porn stars.
Yeah, that helped, yeah.
Yeah, that helped. And he told me that he figured he was getting one or two bets a night because of dealer errors, because of distractions that these girls, you know, and one or two bets a night. I mean, you're playing with an edge already.
Yeah, and, you know, he wasn't, one or two of his bets were, you know, it wasn't,
he was betting $100,000 a hand.
Right, it wasn't $100. He was, I mean, one or two of his bets, it's a lot of money to anyone. And the interesting thing to me also is that blackjack, it was like he was almost a hobbyist because he makes his real money doing something else.
Horses is what he tells us.
Yeah, okay, so he talked about that. Yeah, he makes his real money through horse racing. And blackjack, the way he put it to me, was originally he did it because, and like, you know, what he does in horse racing, the tracks know who he is. They welcome the liquidity. But he's always, you know, he's always fighting to get, I guess, rebates and to get, you know, lower, you know, to get lower commission, I know, whatever it is, to get the advantages you can get. And, you know, I think for him, it was, you know, it was a way that he could, you know, lobby with some of these horse racing people and take them to a casino and fly them on a jet. That was, you know, the, you know what I mean? It wasn't at his, I hope I'm not saying anything I'm supposed to say, but he told me all this, so I assume it's
and
okay.
And he's spoken about similar things here.
Yeah, I mean, like, I thought
actually,
that was,
he talked about it at a World Game Protection Conference.
Okay, well, good, okay. So, I actually thought that was really interesting, is that, like, this guy's, like, won more money than God at blackjack, and that's not even what his main thing. I mean, I found that to
God
be pretty
doesn't play much blackjack, though.
Oh, really?
I thought it was dice. God doesn't roll dice.
The what does Einstein know, though? But when he at Don's acceptance speech at this year's blackjack ball, he mentioned that he had kind of gotten carried away with doing interviews and announcing how good he was and how successful he was. And for some reason, he's run out of games to play. And if he had it all to do over again, he probably wouldn't have given so many interviews.
Well, one thing I will say, though, is he sort of got put into a bad spot because the casino basically blabbed who he was.
Well,
it was the way I heard it was that there was a conference call, you know, and they were explaining how they lost money that quarter, and they said, well, there was a gambler, and then they mentioned his name, and then I think it got written in the Wall Street Journal.
And there were reporters on the
call. Yeah, and it got written up in the Wall Street Journal. It's like, who's this guy? And I think he decided that he would – see, he's like – talk about an AP. He decided he was going to make the most of that situation. And I think it's afforded him some pretty good opportunities that don't involve him playing against casinos. And
yes, he represents pretty high-end champagne. And
He sponsors. You know, he's a celebrity at tournaments. And you know, I think he realized that the blackjack thing wasn't going to last forever. And really, once that was out, I mean, I think he knew his days were numbered.
Yeah.
You know, once a casino says who it is who won the money, I mean, it becomes tough to, you know, show up somewhere and they're going to let you, you know, because at the very least, they're going to do a Google on your name when you come and say, I want about $100,000 a hand.
Well, you would think on the other hand, you know, one of the things that just killed me about the whole situation with Phil Ivey and Kelly was that Bill Zender wrote an article about them doing this in Las Vegas, winning all the money. Now, he didn't mention their names, but he explained exactly what had been done, how it was done, and yet still they were able to go to Borgata and to England and play.
Well, so did, I think, Willie Allison wrote about it also in the Catwalk Report.
Yeah.
Isn't that his thing? He wrote about it as well. And I mean, so it was out there. But you know what, though? I'll bet. If you're a casino guy, right, you work for a casino, Phil Ivey wants to come, he wants to put a couple $1 million on deposit and come gamble in your place, then all of a sudden you say no. You say, you know what, we're not going to give you those cards that you want us to use. We're not going to use those. And he'll be like, well, he's not going to do it then, obviously. He's like, you know what, I don't really like being told what to do by casino. This is pure
speculation. Phil Ivey did a masterful job of setting himself up as a degenerate gambler.
Oh,
and he was playing craps, like Don Johnson, with a big loss rebate. But the word around town was, oh, he's a degenerate craps player.
Oh, yeah. Right. You know? So, but could you imagine being the guy who says, no, we can't use this brand of cards you want us to use. And then they go, what happened to the $3 million that Phil Ivey put on deposit? Oh, yeah. He told him he wouldn't use the cards he wanted to use. Phil got pissed off and left. I think that guy would certainly have to answer a couple questions. And, I mean, I think that there is
But there was a casino here in Vegas that he went in and tried to get it on. And there was one casino here, even though I think they beat three casinos here in Vegas. But the fourth one, he made his requests, and the guy laughed and said, are you crazy? No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it takes somebody to say that. But, I mean, I think a lot of people are...
Well, that's because the people running casinos don't understand the games anymore.
Well,
that's why.
That's completely possible. That's completely possible. I mean, one casino executive said to me, this was said off the record, so I didn't put it in my story. He goes, when Chinese people start telling me to turn cards, I put my hands in my pocket and make sure nobody's getting my money.
All right. We've been talking to Michael Kaplan about a number of his articles. They're all posted on the Gambling with an Edge webpage. Thank you very much, Michael Kaplan. This is a lot of fun. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, you're very welcome. This was awesome.
And go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.